shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Every single spring, that first day that I walk outside and I see that yellow dust all over my truck, I'm like, that is Satan's dandruff. It destroys me. I legitimately can't go outside for longer than 3 minutes because my eyes get swollen, my eyes get puffy, my nose gets congested, and I just simply can't breathe. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so that you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. When I started taking Claritin D about 2 months ago, I can finally get back outside and play pickleball again, which is what I love to do, but I couldn't do it because my allergies were so bad. Claritin D has legitimately allowed me to go outside again. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. Thursday, March 7th, 2024. You are listening to the Carlos Whitaker Podcast. Drop it. That's right. Welcome to episode 10. Oh man, we're double digits of the brand new Carlos Whitaker Broadcast. Human Hope Familia, you're still here. I know. I see you. I feel you. And I'm grateful that you are all here, that you've all decided to hop into a, oh man, today, the amount of, oh, that's good. The amount of, oh yeah. Oh man, that's really good. Oh, come on now. The amount of those things that were, I was trying to not say because it would ruin the listening experience. There was a lot of them because today's guest is back. Men, women, and children. Todd is in the building. Todd Dethridge, one of the founders of the Telos Group, whose vision is for mutual flourishing. They envision a world in which leaders in their communities claim the requisite drive, expertise, and relationships to effectively and relentlessly wage peace. So we are talking to an expert peacemaker as we fade out Dr. Delight today on the show. And Todd, I basically come at him, you know, Todd was on here a couple episodes ago. He so eloquently laid out what was going on in Israel and Palestine. So two episodes ago, is peace possible between Israel and Palestine with Todd Dethridge? He came in and it was great. It was a great conversation, which led to a lot more questions from you. So some of the questions that I just, basically today's podcast is your questions straight to Todd. And the ability that he has to speak to people coming from different points of view on this subject is actually fascinating. I was watching, it was like a masterclass, and you're about to witness it, in being able to have a nuanced, highly emotionally charged, yet important conversation the way he did it. I think he could have this conversation with anybody, no matter what your point of view is on the conflict. Friends, let's just get right into it because it's so, there's some of the questions. Is it possible to be both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine as a believer? Okay, that's from a Christian perspective, I'm assuming. Isn't this war ultimately creating more extremism on both sides? Why do no other Arab countries want to admit Palestinian refugees? How do you talk to your very blank parents about the blank conflict when their only stance is blank? What would a successful ceasefire look like for both sides? What will it take to get there? We talk about the disbelief in the numbers. what his perspective is for people that question the numbers that we're getting from the Hamas health ministry. Well, I asked him all of your hard questions, and I think you're going to really appreciate, even if you don't agree, you're going to appreciate his balanced, nuanced, and very educated responses. So without further ado, is this, yes, that's the right song. Let's get into a conversation with our old friend now, because he's been on the podcast 2 times in 3 weeks, Todd Dethridge. Okay, podcast family, I am back with your old friend and my old friend now, Todd. Todd, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Great to be back. Thanks for calling me again.
I'll go ahead and tell you, you've broken like a couple records. There's only a few people that have ever been on the podcast twice. So and I'm saying maybe 3. So you've now joined a select group, and you're the fastest person that I've had back on the podcast after they were on it before. And so thank you for breaking those records, Todd.
Well, I'm honored, but it also may just because I'm talking about such a timely issue in real, something's happening.
Absolutely.
But it's an honor to be invited back.
Thank yeah. You so much. No, it's good. And, so, I mean, what I thought I would just do is, you know, you did such a great job on the first episode, unpacking the conflict, unpacking kind of what the Telos group does, unpacking, what peace could possibly look like, and even giving us a couple of practical tools and practical things that we can do, those that are listening, you know, to maybe lean into, becoming peacemakers in whatever area they may be. Then what I did is I opened up the conversation to my listeners and my Instagram audience and said, hey, like, from whatever perspective you're coming, whatever worldview you're coming to this, viewing this conflict from, I actually don't care what side you're looking from. If you have a question for Todd, here's the question box and throw it out there. Todd, would love to answer them. So I've got, just some questions that I just would love to throw your way, and then I'll just let you talk. If you don't mind, we could just do it that way.
That sounds great.
Okay. Amazing. This person is coming from a faith perspective. I believe the way the question is phrased, and the question is it possible to be both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine as a believer?
It's a great question. And I think it suggests, it really depends on how you answer the question. What do you believe about the world that God made and how we're meant to live in it? If you believe in the shalom of God, the wholeness and unity of God that was designed in the beginning, that's kind of given to us in the book of Genesis in the garden, and you believe in the kingdom of God and the wholeness that God is bringing about, the restoration of all things into that wholeness, then how can you not be but for all the people there? We use the language not of pro-Israel and pro-Palestine, but pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian.
Okay.
Trying to get even beyond the kind of nationalism that's attached to those framings into the humanity of all the people there. The Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Israelis, and Palestinians who live there are all human beings made in the image of God and deserving to have that honored and respected in equal ways.
Yeah.
And so if you believe in that, then you have to reject these ideas that we live in a zero sum world.
Yeah.
A world in which might makes right, in which for me to win, somebody has to lose. Cause that's so much of the world and all its fallenness. Again, to lean into the religious language that is implied by this question. The world and its fallenness and brokenness suggests that there are winners and losers, and that my winning is comes at your losing, basically, and vice versa. And we're suggesting that that's the wrong way to think about it. That the only way that we really build a world that is more just and peaceful, for everyone is to remember our interconnectedness.
Yeah.
It can't be zero sum. Zero sum looks like what's happening right now, that Palestinians are being, killed in such numbers, so much destruction in Gaza, and there's all this pressure to even push them out of the Gaza Strip, to displace them even further. And that kind of displacement is what zero sum gets you. Mutuality is connected. It's very much what we learned from Dr. King. Dr. King had a really famous quote that he used different versions of over and over again, and people can Google it, but it's about how all life is interconnected. I can't be everything I'm meant to be unless you're who are you meant to be, and vice versa. And the nature of reality is that we are interconnected, and that, again, that's from Dr. King. Wow. And then this is where he famously ends it by saying, in that way, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. And so we have to correct injustices in the world to make the world more just, not just for people that are in the immediate term enduring injustice, but for all of us. That makes us all more, makes the world, you know, better for all of us.
I love that. Pro-Israeli and Palestinian as opposed to pro-Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
It humanizes it, which is exactly what needs to happen.
That's the point. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Somebody asked, isn't this war ultimately creating more extremism on both sides? What's your perspective?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's how we got here. And that's what's happening right now, is that those extremist voices, those who reject these ideas of mutuality, they reject the ideas that we can be neighbors, reject these kinds of things, they're the ones that have completely seized the reins and are pushing all the things that we've been seeing. And the way in which extremism is going to grow from this, it should really be not just concerning, but really terrifying to all of us, that we have an entire generation now who have witnessed these, both the horror and the massacre of October 7th and the absolute tragedy of 30,000 now dead in Gaza, and the whole area just rubble and ruins. And now we have the desperation of mass starvation happening. All of that is doing nothing but creating more radicalization of people all throughout the Middle East, because when at the core of these ideologies that require all the Jews to leave or all the Arabs or Palestinians to leave the land, to be pushed out, to be defeated, at the core of these exclusive ideologies, or is just that there's this, I mean, it's a future that, again, is entirely built on zero sum. Yeah. And yet when you don't have any better rallying vision for what the world could look like, people get drawn to those extremist views if they don't have anything better. Uh-huh. And you have these bad ideas that have just grown and grown on all sides of this conflict for the last many years, because there's been no honest effort to try to deal with it, to try to solve it. And so in the absence of that, and now we just get that playing out in fullness. John Stewart said something the other night about, you know, is there a bomb that kills an idea? Because there's not. And when you have an idea, like the Israelis say that the goal is to destroy Hamas. Hamas is an idea.
Right.
And what they're actually doing is creating a lot more Hamas, a lot more attraction to ideas that are like that, because of all the death and destruction that's taking place of innocent people and innocent lives at such a scale. And so you can't kill a bad idea with bombs and bullets.
Wow.
You kill a bad idea, but you push it to the margins by offering a better idea, by offering a more holistic, true vision for what reality should look like and could look like and what we have to work toward. And that pushes the bad idea. If you could kill a bad idea, we've done away with anti-Semitism and white supremacy and, you know, and the lost cause narrative of the Confederacy here and things like that a long time ago. You push those things to the margins by offering a more holistic vision of how we move forward. Yeah. When you don't offer those, then those extremist ideologies grow. And you're seeing this on the Israeli side right now too, and the far right in Israel really calling for mass displacement of Gazans, wanting to push them fully out and take all this land and settle it and dispel displace the Palestinians who live there. And that's been a dream for this movement that has actually now seized power in Israel, even in ways that are pushing us more toward extremism. So yes, all of this is making the world less safe and more extreme. And it really demands a response of a vision that's rooted in the humanity of everyone, all Palestinians, all Israelis are, you know, are image bearers or have human dignity. To wherever you, however you arrive at that, they all, that has to be respected and understood. And then they, we have to cast vision for how they can live differently in equitable, in an equitable reality on the other side of all this.
The, I mean, that was so good. The, within everything that you said, I just think of the people that have gotten to the space in their minds. I would even say not only with this conflict, but with the conflict in general. And I see a lot of this in American politics now, to where it is either use, this is a war on whatever they're going to say, and you strong arm your, we're going to have to strong arm our way to success. What do you feel like it would look like, to actually, like, what would a successful ceasefire actually look like for both sides? Like, what will act, what will it actually take? Do you believe, obviously nobody really knows, but do you believe, what it take to get there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the two things that have tied, have to be, are being tied together, that have to go together, are the hostages, that the Israeli hostages that are being held in Gaza have to be released.
Yes.
And the Israelis have to stop killing innocent people in Gaza, stop the blockade that is preventing adequate food and supplies from coming in. People are dying from hunger, malnutrition, and disease now because of the blockade. Not just from bombs being dropped from the air and all that's going on with that. So all of these, like, all of this has to come as a package. And
yeah,
and so ultimately there's no way we get to anything until we stop doing these things. Mm-hmm. As we have said from day one of this at Telos, violence is how we got into this. Violence in all its forms is how we got into this. It's not how we get out. Mm-hmm. We cannot kill our way out of this. Nothing that Hamas did on October 7th made Palestine more free. Nothing that Israel has done since then has made Israel more safe and secure. This is, we, this is the playbook we've been playing by, just in a more extreme way. And this is how we got trapped here. And we're staying trapped here because we're still doing the same stuff, just at magnitude and scale now.
Yeah.
Until we get to a place where we realize that that's not going to get us where we want to be, even in our own self-interest, if it's not, if we can't see the humanity in the other, in our own self-interest, these, this is not the way. So we have to get to that place first. And a ceasefire and a release of hostages is the starting point. It ends nothing. It's just a starting point of enormous work that has to be done on the other side.
This week, we are once again partnering with Aqua True, the water filter system that my family uses to make sure that the water we drink is good for our bodies. Okay, I want you to check out Aqua True. Aqua True purifiers use a four-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers work with no installation or plumbing. Can I tell y'all something? That is exactly what I needed, because I am horrible when it comes to wrenches and pipes and water. So thank goodness that Aqua True was so easy to install. They remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters and are specifically designed to combat chemicals like PFAS in your water supply. And here's the thing, they have water purifiers to fit every type of home, from installation-free countertop purifiers like the ones we have to higher capacity under the sink options if you're a little fancier than I am. Okay, I understand this, please. Long-term exposure to high concentrations of PFAS can potentially lead to adverse health effects like cancer, endocrine system disruption, and liver toxicity, which is why I'm glad that Aqua True removes all that nasty junk. The filters are affordable and long-lasting. You don't have to change filters every 2 or 3 months. Aqua True filters last from 6 months to 2 years. It's even portable, making it perfect for those of you that are renting, or if you've got college dorms, if you're living in a college dorm or whatever. If you got pets, your pets are part of your family too. Make sure they're drinking healthy water as well. I literally can truly taste the difference compared to my old water filter. Legitimately can, okay? And also, it got delivered straight to my home, and it was so easy to set up. It makes my drinking of water so much easier, and it's actually kind of fun too. So, Aqua True comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. and even makes a great gift. To my listeners today, you get 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. Just go to AquaTrue.com. That's AquaTrue.com and enter code HUMANHOPE at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue water purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com and use promo code HUMANHOPE. I am so grateful that Shopify has made me selling stuff so easy. I started using Shopify just for one single t-shirt years ago, and now they help me sell my books. They help me sell all my merch. I've sold hoodies on there, all sorts of stuff. If you're looking for a partner to begin to help you make selling online so much easier, Shopify is going to be for you. I need you to understand that a key moment in my business was when Shopify took over all of my online ordering. It took over my online store platform. It took over everything. And I found out that Shopify powers 10%. That's a lot of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify's the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. So you don't even have to live in the USA. I need you to understand that Shopify, when you sign up right now, Shopify is going to give you a $1 per month trial period. All you got to do is go to Shopify.com/Carlos. All lowercase, please. Go to Shopify.com/Carlos now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Carlos. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. For those of us that hear that and are like, yeah, of course. But aren't well versed in Washington, D.C., or politics in general, or, embassies and the whole work. What does that what does that process actually look like from a perspective of politics, from a perspective of who are the ones that have to be having these conversations? Who is going to be, we can all feel that, but who needs to hear this, and who's going to get there, I guess?
Well, many in the world, many international powers, foreign countries, the United Nations, others have been calling for a ceasefire.
Yes.
Been huge demonstrations in the streets of capitals around the world, including here in the United States and other countries in Europe and the Arab world and in other parts of the world, calling for a ceasefire for a long time. But what hasn't happened is that the most important country at the leadership level that matters outside of Israel and is the United States has not been willing to demand a ceasefire. The United States has, in fact, vetoed several resolutions that different countries have brought forward into the United Nations Security Council calling for a ceasefire. That's changing. The dynamics are changing in the United States. There's been so much outcry by people saying this is not the way from a variety of places, from the kind of pro-Palestine activist community and the progressive community, but to others as well who are saying this is not the way. This doesn't help anybody. And that pressure starting to be felt, and then added to that, just the absolute horror and nightmare of the reality. I mean, I really have been gutted in the last few days in a whole new way, seeing the level of desperation people in Gaza have to be feeling when these aid convoys are finally allowed through, and how desperate people are to feed their families, that they're, and all these things are happening in real time. And so all of that, I think, is creating the pressure that needs to happen, but needs to continue to be placed on our own. Like, America plays a giant role in this. This is not something we're disconnected from. So much is being done in our name. And so if we are okay with that, as I think said last time, that's all right. But if we're not okay with that, we actually need to let our elected representatives know we're not okay with that, that this is not serving anybody's interest.
Yeah.
It's certainly not serving the interests of the people in Gaza, but it's not serving the long-term interests of Israelis or Americans or regional or global security.
Yeah.
And so understanding that is like we actually have a voice. It matters. and using it is really important at a time like this.
That's so good. I mean, it matters using your voice. Make the phone call. Call your representative. Let them know. The amount of people that probably think, oh, it won't make a difference. You know, it does. It actually does.
Collectively, it does make a difference. It's been making a difference.
And yeah.
It needs to keep happening.
So. Yeah. No, that's good. I think one of the, you know, and I actually may not, I think earlier, you know, maybe late 2023, early 2024, there was a lot of, I think, disbelief that I was seeing, you know, around online about the numbers, that are either killed or starving in Gaza because, people hear Hamas, Hamas Health Ministry. And yep. Can you maybe help the people that I got some questions like sure. this that are like, well, how do we really know? Because, you know, so anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a question that's been raised so many times, and people honestly wanting to know an answer, not just cynically. What I would suggest is starting with the fact that the health ministry in Gaza has been, you know, doing its work, you know, for a long time, and the United States and many other countries around the world and human rights organizations have used the data from the health ministry historically in our own internal reporting. So when you look at U.S. State Department reports about previous conflicts between Israel and the Hamas in Gaza, especially the largest one, which is in 2014, but in others. And if you look at the reports of human rights organizations and international relief organizations about death tolls and injuries and so forth in Gaza and these kinds of things, we have always relied on those. Mm. And when the dust has settled, I am aware of nothing that's ever suggested that these were, you know, wildly inflated or made up at all. And so because they've continued to be used in that way. So that's been something important to remember. And what was really, I think, discouraging for many who know that is that when the President of the United States himself and President Biden back early on dismissed that idea that we don't know if we can trust these numbers. And it felt to many Palestinians, especially here in the United States, is this erasure of Palestinian legitimacy and identity that you can't even believe our numbers and we don't exist in that way.
Yeah.
And that was very disheartening when the president did that. And it gave, you know, voice and legitimacy to a critique that many on the other side used to dismiss and diminish Palestinian suffering and humanity by saying, well, these numbers are made up.
Yeah.
And I'm not expert in this. My understanding is that every one of these numbers is tied to an actual human being with a, you know, and they have an identity number and all that. And so, ultimately we'll know what the numbers are. My fear is that it's going to be worse than we actually know now, because I think there may be so many that were killed. And they're left under, you know, ruins and rubble and that sort of thing that haven't been identified, and in the chaos of it all, the numbers actually may be undercounted. But I don't know. In some way, it doesn't matter the exact number, because what we know is that there is a tragedy of historic proportions happening. That we know that there are thousands and thousands who have died by Israeli, you know, military accounts. There are thousands who have died. And we know that there's mass destruction on a sort of epic, almost biblical scale in terms of the destruction of this, of buildings and infrastructure and of the land itself. And we know that at some point there will be histories written about this, and there will be museums commemorating the tragedy of what happened, there will be people who will not come out well in those, and I think our president will be one of them who does not, whose reputation is really diminished by the way he himself has contributed to this kind of the diminishing of Palestinian humanity through this whole thing.
Yeah. Wow. I guess, you know, looking historically at that, and that is very helpful. At the numbers that we've been presented and used, and as the dust has settled in historical conflicts, those numbers have been accurate. And so, you know, why would they shift them now? I hear that. This is a question that I think is coming from a lot of people, especially in America that grew up in the 80s and the 90s, have parents, that not only parents, but we could have friends that believe that there's only one way a Christian needs to view this conflict, right? And so the question that I got from a listener very specifically is, how do you talk to your very evangelical parent about the Palestine conflict when their only stance is that Christians stand with Israel? Now, that may be a little bit more of a psychology question, but what would you say? Say you're talking to a parent, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a very legitimate question. I mean, I think first of all, ask curious questions about what they mean by standing with it. Really, like, honestly, don't ask. Like, we talked on the last in our last conversation, we talked about listening to understand, which is about asking following questions rather than leading questions. Yeah. So you're not trying necessarily to lead them to where you want them to be. You're trying to follow them to where they're going and find out why they believe that, and then what it means to them to stand with Israel, and to see if it surfaces anything that can be a bridge that you can connect into, because you can also ask them. I mean, you know, what does it really look like to stand with Israel? What does it look like to be a friend to Israel? And connect that to your own understanding of what it means, you know, to flourish in the world.
Yeah.
About being a good neighbor, about loving justice, about loving enemies. Yeah. And about, you know, what then ask, you know, to think together about what a path forward might be that would allow Israelis to flourish in real security. And what connection that might have to Palestinians also having those same things. And then, you know, see if there are other ways to think about faith and scripture, other things that would apply in terms of, again, what Jesus taught us about how to, again, to love our neighbor, to love our enemy, to be peacemakers in the world, the centrality of justice for these things, because there are other things, that other theologies that we can bring to the conversation besides just either end times theologies about Israel's role in the end times, or just kind of reductive readings of the, you know, Genesis passage where God says, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, and extrapolating that into contemporary, you know, the kind of modern nation state of Israel and how the United States of America in 2024 should relate to it and how Christians should think about it. But it involves conversations and questions. And it's also remembering that, you know, people, whatever experiences that we may have in terms of our own understanding, the relationships we may have that have helped us understand this in a more holistic way, the big stories that we've heard or whatever, maybe our parents haven't had those relationships. They haven't had those experiences. Remembering that it's often through story and relationship and experience that we open ourselves up to seeing things differently. And just an argumentation about the history and the facts it rarely ever moves anybody to think differently.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, just being curious, asking questions, looking for opportunities to find commonality, build bridges, looking for opportunities to introduce different stories to people and different, different experiences to people. All those have the potential to open people, but don't write, you know, some people you can just say, well, you know, we can't agree on this and we have to, you know, we have to still be in relationship or family. We're not going to let this divide, you know, break our family dynamic or relationship. But also it's, you know, it's important to not just write people off either and to hold open the possibility that, that change can happen. And, you know, and it's not our job to convert everybody to everything, but it's our job to love people, but it's also our job to, in a moment like this, when we know something really horrific is happening and unjust, that it's our moment to speak out because, this is an historic moment. And we often, especially as I hear younger people sometimes say, you know, what would have been like if I'd lived during the civil rights era or what would I have done in this earlier point in history when this, you know, thing was happening? This is one of those historical moments. And I think whatever you're doing now is probably a lot similar to what you might have been doing at those other moments in time, because this is a moment of just real epic historic tragedy happening in real time.
Yeah.
And it needs to be kind of seen that way and confronted in that way.
I've got a lot of listeners that got themselves some little kids, and you're always looking to make sure that your kids are staying as healthy as possible. That is where Hiya comes in. Okay. typical children's vitamins are basically candy in disguise. You know this. If you grew up in the 80s, your parents were just giving you candy. Thank you for trying, Mom and Dad. But Hiya has solved this problem. While most children's vitamins are filled with 5 grams of sugar and can contribute to a variety of health issues, Hiya is made with zero sugar and zero gummy junk, yet it tastes great and is perfect for your picky eaters. Hiya fills in the most common gaps in modern children's diets to provide the full body nourishment our kids need with a yummy taste that they love. Hiya is designed for kids of all ages and it's sent straight to your door so you don't have to go shopping for your vitamins. You have one less thing to worry about, okay? I love that Hiya vitamins get delivered straight to our door as well. And I love that Hiya vitamins are formulated with the help of nutritional experts and that they're pressed with this, get this, all kinds of organic fruits and veggies and supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, and so many more. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you got to go to HiyaHealth.com/humanhope. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to HiyaHealth.com/humanhope and get your kids the full-body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is, when it comes to family, you know, I do agree that the relationship, it needs to be the most important thing that stays intact in order for even the conversations to continue.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's good. One or two more. This has been so helpful, I think, for a lot of people. One question I got, and actually I didn't do any research on this question itself, so I don't even know if this is something that is completely true or not. But a question is, why do no other Arab countries want to admit Palestinian refugees?
This is a very good and very fair question.
Okay.
And I think first you have to center it in mostly on Egypt.
Okay.
Because Egypt shares a border. The Gaza Strip has 3 land borders and a sea border.
Yeah.
2 of the land borders are with Israel and the southern border is with Egypt. And so that has to kind of, so it really kind of be, it has to be centered in on Egypt because yeah. Egypt has the, ostensibly the ability to open up that border to allow people to cross. So to go back to the history of modern Egypt and modern Israel, you know, when Israel was created in 1948, they had a war that they had to fight to achieve their independence, and they fought it with not with the Palestinians, who they had largely displaced by the time independence was declared in 48, but with the Arab countries around them, including Egypt, and so they lived in this, you know, kind of sea of hostility for the first 20 years, first 30 years, and then ultimately in 1978, Egypt and Israel made a peace agreement. And that has been kind of this cornerstone of both their kind of security postures ever since. It's been a cold peace. It's not been a peace that's been embraced at the level of society, but between their governments and militaries, it's definitely held strong through the years. Egypt has cooperated with Israel, particularly for the past 17 years in this blockade. And so that needs to be understood too. Israel created a blockade of Gaza after the Hamas took over 17 years ago, but they've done it in full cooperation with Egypt as well. It's been led by the Israelis, but it's been completely, you know, cooperated with by the Egyptians. Egypt is headed by a military leader who seized power, from an elected, government back several years ago that was it was headed by an Islamist party, which was affiliated with the same movement that Hamas is a part of.
Okay.
And so the current government doesn't like Hamas. In fact, they probably hate the Hamas almost as much as the Israelis do.
Yeah.
And so there's no love lost between them. And what Egypt, I think, probably on the just in the most cynical way, Egypt doesn't want the instability that would come with such a huge number of Palestinian sure. refugees coming to their country, potentially creating unwanted pressures on in opposition to the military rule of President Sisi there now. So that's all. It's all very. That's kind of the realpolitik, cynical version of some of this too. The other part of it, though, is kind of ideological.
Okay.
And so let's look at the far right Zionist movement inside Israel. Their ambition is to create a state that is Jewish within this land between this Mediterranean and the Jordan. And the idea is that would be a democratic state, right? But that is directly challenged by the fact that there are basically equal numbers of Arabs and Jews that live in this land. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to be Israel controlling it and saying it's all Jewish, it can't be democratic. And so one of the ways to deal with that is to get rid of as many Palestinians or Arabs that live in this land as possible. And so that has been an ongoing, dream of the far right in Israel for a long time.
Yeah.
And what this war has given them an opportunity to do is to push for full displacement of as many of the 2.2 million people who live in Gaza as possible into Egypt. That is their dream, or to have them resettled into other parts of the world. And some of those far right people are actually in the current Israeli government.
Yes.
And so they are that voice at that table, at that level, able to argue for this position. And what Egypt and others don't want to happen is Palestinians to be displaced and never allowed to be returned. Because mm-hmm. you have to look at it from the Palestinian perspective, which is in 1948, most Palestinians, over 700,000 Palestinians, were displaced in 47 and 48 as Israel was created, and so they became refugees, and they were promised that they would be allowed to return when the fighting was over. They fled during the war, and many were forced out of their village. Some just fled because the war was happening, but they left with the idea of returning and with the promise of returning, and that was affirmed by the United Nations. It's been affirmed over and over again in international bodies and law and so forth, and by countries around the world, that they have this right to return. And that's been one of the negotiating things that in all the previous rounds of negotiations was this idea of the right to return.
Yeah.
But they've never been allowed to return. In fact, 65% of the people who live in Gaza are refugees from 1948. And so the idea of having them displaced again, having them leave under the guise of it might be temporary. Mm-hmm. It's like our story forever. We've already seen this play out. We're not going to leave, and Arab countries don't want to be complicit in allowing them to leave and not being able to guarantee that they can return, which then undermines the Palestinian cause of self-determination. And the idea of a Palestinian state in any form alongside Israel or however you want to construct it. But it actually creates even greater regional instability if you have further diminished the idea of this conflict being resolved in a just and fair way. And so there's a lot, there's a lot that goes into that. But all of that, I think, has to be kind of put in the mix, at least to understand why.
That is so helpful. I mean, so good. People have... I know a lot of people that during the initial stages of this were, I'm pro Israel. It was very this, I'm either this or I'm that, but I'm getting a lot more people that are like, well, legitimately the question is, where is it? It was actually on my Instagram. I was just reading it. I am pro Israel, which I would challenge this person to change that to Israeli. Now that you've taught me that, I love that. I am pro Israel, but struggling with the carnage in Gaza. How will Israel recover with the U.S. far left? And then I think, that's, I'm also wondering what you have heard or seen from inside of Israel, where there are Israelis who I don't think I'm hearing about Israelis that I can't fathom would be like, yes, this slaughter is exactly what I feel like needs to be happening. Are there voices from inside of Israel that are pushing back against maybe what they're seeing happening in Gaza, as well as people that are feeling that, that may have said I'm pro-Israel at the beginning of this conflict as well, that are like, oh, but wait a second, this isn't necessarily what I thought was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, yes. So you have to put yourself in the most of us have very quickly moved beyond October 7th.
Right.
That was a horror. It was an unjustifiable horror. It was a massacre. It was a slaughter. And it has to be fully denounced. But the response to that was so immediate, and the horror and tragedy of the response is still going on. And so it's like the magnitude of what happened on October 7th and what the appropriate human response to that has been almost kind of shelved. Sure. As we've had to deal with this other thing. And at some point that still has to be fully grieved, understood, and accounted for. And yeah, Hamas should be held accountable for what happened that day and so forth. But Israelis are still living in the full trauma of that. Yes. So that experience was not just this one-time episode of a trauma where 1,200 people were murdered and others were kidnapped, but it was a continuation of a historic experience of the Jewish people.
That's good.
Over history. So it awakened something deeply traumatic in their psyches. And so it was also a great sort of shame to the Israeli military and security establishment. Sure. And the political establishment for what was allowed to happen. Yeah. That day. And so the response to it, out of the sense of shame and trauma and everything else, was this immediate, hit back without any real strategic, achievable strategic goal other than to destroy Hamas.
Right.
Again, we talked about that already. How, like, what does that even mean? How do you destroy an idea? And how futile it is to do that in this way, you know. And so anyway, but that's still where a lot of people are. And so there's still this visceral response. Absolutely. To that, and a frustration that the world has not stayed focused on that, but has really focused so much attention on what's happening immediately. Wow. in Gaza, right? So that's all going on. Out of all that, though, you have many of the hostage families who've been protesting, marching, and being joined by others to say, this is not the way. We need a negotiation. And if that involves a ceasefire to get these back, in fact, many are saying that's the only way to get the hostages back is through ceasefire. That's the only way that any have gotten released, except the Israeli military managed to get two released a few weeks ago. But other than that, all the 100 and something that have come back have come through negotiations. And so there's pressure to do that.
Right.
As a way to get to stop what was happening now, to create a ceasefire that would allow hostage release. That's happening. And then there are some who just really are seeing the inhumanity of what's happening in Gaza and not wanting to identify with that as Israelis, saying what it means for me to be an Israeli and to how to live in the world. And so there's that opposition. The government has really cracked down in this time of war in dissent. So particularly amongst Palestinian citizens of Israel, about 20% of the citizens of the state of Israel are Arab or Palestinian. And many of them have come under enormous pressure, been arrested for social media posts or likes. And have been interrogated, and really an effort has been made to silence them. But there are Jewish Israelis who've also been silenced during this time, and protest movements have been really cracked down on by the police and state authorities and so forth. That's starting to change. You see a protest movement building again inside Israel. Uh-huh. and connected to a different approach on this. And ultimately this will end.
Yeah.
And the government will have to be held account in Israel for their failure on October 7th.
Yeah.
And the prime minister is the chief person in that way, and he had that's part of what his vested interest is in keeping this conflict going, is because the minute that it stops, then the music really stops. Sure. Playing for him, he has to be accountable to his own public for what he did, even leading up to that.
Yes. And it sounds like accountability is coming for Hamas, for what happened, for that atrocity that happened. That is something that must happen. Accountability, right? There, but accountability must happen for the tens of thousands of innocent lives that have been lost as well.
That's right.
And that accountability is there. Yeah.
The death of innocent civilians is always wrong.
Always.
And unjustifiable. And needs accountability in all of this. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. In order for these things to stop, accountability must happen so that know, in the future. What, one last question. It actually says, no question. Todd was my high school teacher. I had him and my wife. Tell him thank you.
Wow. That's hilarious. Does it give a name?
It actually, it just says, Gertie Rocks is their Instagram name. So I don't even know.
I don't know. Well,
I don't know who it is, but I'm like, look at this. Todd's got some high school students that are like, hey, that was me back in the day.
I have not been in the classroom in more than 30 years, but I was a high school history teacher a long time ago.
Who knew? Look at
back
that.
Back in Arkansas. Yeah, that's really fun. I love that.
Yeah, so somebody, a high school student from the past is saying hello. And again, I just want to say just thank you so much. This is just, I'm telling you, your gift. And I just need you to keep on giving and hear it from me that you're not only a gift to everyone else, but to me. And I just really appreciate it.
Carlos, that means so much. I really respect you and appreciate you saying that. And thanks for having me on again. I really have enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
That was so good, Todd. Woo. So many nuggets, so many perspective shifting statements that he gave. I know one thing I'm going to stop saying and start saying. I'm going to stop saying referring to this as pro-Israel and pro-Palestine and start referring to it as pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian. When he said that, that was kind of like a gut punch. I was like, wow, the dehumanization and even the language. So good. So thank you, Todd. If you guys want to find out more information about Todd and the Telos Group, there will be links in the show notes. They're doing a great work and I appreciate him. I also appreciate you hanging in here for some of these more crucial conversations. This is the important work, right? This is the important stuff. And again, I appreciate that the perspectives that were brought were from people that look at this conflict in two different ways. And we were able to have a conversation together. It's possible. It is possible. And I'm grateful. Hey, listen, don't forget that I need all of you, every single one of you that's listening to this right now, to go into the show notes and click on the podcast survey, trying to find as much information as I can about my podcast listeners. It's going to be very helpful for how I serve you, trying to serve you. Okay. Also, what'd you think about last week's episode as well? Like, I think that I want to do more of those where you just kind of open the floor up for a little Q&A. I had a good time. I enjoyed that as well. Hey, Dr. Delight, can you please drop a beat? Nope, that's not the beat. Hey, Dr. Delight, can you please drop a beat? There it is. Men, women, and children, hope is in the building. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been episode 10 of the Carlos Whitaker Podcast. I'm so grateful for you. Thanks for hanging out with Todd and I, and hopefully gave you a little bit of food for thought. I love you. I appreciate you. And I will see you next week on another episode of the Carlos Whitaker Podcast.